Hello everyone, my name is Tom Wagenmakers.
And I'm Pieter Zylstra.
And welcome to the 9th episode of our podcast, A Global Perspective on European Politics. Today, we are going to discuss whether NATO provoked Russia by declaring that Ukraine and Georgia would become members of the alliance in 2008. Our guest today is Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, who is none other than the former Secretary General of NATO. And he is going to provide us with a lot of interesting facts on NATO-Russia diplomacy. Jaap, thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
What we hear a lot nowadays is that NATO has been provoking Russia by offering membership to Ukraine in 2008. You were Secretary General at that time, right? So my first question to you is there actually a direct connection between the 2008 promise of NATO membership to Georgia and Ukraine and the current war that's going on in Ukraine?
Well, I think I would go with your question, of course, but not with the word provoking. I do not think that NATO has provoked Russia or provoked Vladimir Putin. But the compromise which NATO reached finally in that during that summit in Bucharest in April 2008 under my chairmanship was, when I look back at it, not the right way to go for NATO, because NATO made a promise to Ukraine and to Georgia, but to Ukraine, in the phrase, they will become NATO members, Ukraine and Georgia. And NATO knew then, and NATO knows now, that it cannot deliver on that promise. And I vividly remember that the next day after this compromise, which came about after a bitter fight between Chancellor Merkel of Germany and Sarkozy, the then French president, on the one hand, and American President George W. Bush, on the other hand, they had a really bitter political fight. This was the compromise text. And the next morning, Putin made it crystal clear to me when I met him in a bilateral conversation that he would not accept that. So, yes, when your question is the invasion into Georgia in August 2008, the annexation of Crimea in 2014, and the horrible war Putin is now waging in and against Ukraine, it is certainly not a direct consequence of that NATO compromise, because any compromise or any text would have been armament for Putin to make his dream come true, reinstating his empire. But the but is that I do not think that it was NATO's finest hour in Bucharest in April 2008. But again, sometimes as the Secretary General of NATO, you are more secretary than general. And when the big ones start to fight, you know, the English saying, I should phrase it correctly, the English saying goes, when elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. Well, I was the grass. You see, this bitter fight between those leaders resulted in this compromise. And I think it's a rather ugly compromise in retrospect.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. But you say that now, when you look back, you think that it's a mistake, right? You said.
Well, in the run up to that summit, I must tell you that when I went to Washington for a preparatory meeting for that summit, yeah, I had a pre dinner before I was going to meet the president in the Oval Office the next day. I had a meeting with Condoleezza Rice, the then Secretary of State, Bob Gates, the then Secretary of Defense, and Stephen Hadley, who was Bush's national security advisor at the time. And they, all three of them, were very reticent, if not negative, on bringing Ukraine a step closer to NATO. The topic was membership action plan. The topic was not yet membership, but membership action plan, MAP, MAP. Yeah. But those three told me, this is our opinion, but we do not know what you're going to hear in the Oval Office tomorrow. And in the Oval Office tomorrow, I heard the opposite message from the horse's mouth, the president's mouth. Some people say that it was Cheney's, Vice President Cheney's, strong preference, and then afterwards also Bush's preference, to go and push for Ukraine membership of NATO. That is the complete picture. So I'll not say it's a mistake, but I qualify this as an ugly compromise. Compromises are often ugly, but this was an ugly compromise, because you should not make promises on which you cannot deliver. although I, as a Secretary General, I immediately admit, I have, of course, defended in Bucharest and afterwards that compromise, because that was the political decision by the leaders of NATO. And then I, as Secretary General, can say the opposite, but then you don't live long, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah. Right. So also the fact that there was not a time frame given to Georgia and Ukraine, is that, was that part of a compromise?
That was very much part of the compromise. It was when they will become NATO members, when hell freezes over, as the English saying goes, or when pigs can fly. So the part of the compromise, essential part of the compromise, was there was no timing in it at all. They will become NATO members, can be in 2150.
Right.
So that was the compromise. But still, there was speak of membership of NATO for Ukraine and Georgia. And that's crucial language, of course.
So you would say that the compromise was made because of intergovernmental struggles and not because of taking Russia into account?
No, it was simply and quite understandable that Germany, under the able leadership of Angela Merkel, with its relationship with Russia, do not forget that the Berlin-Moscow relationship for Germany is almost as important as Berlin-Paris. That's why Scholz is now in such a big trouble during the war in Ukraine. That Merkel, who was definitely no friend of Putin, very strongly opposed this whole exercise, given the fact that she realized that this might well be casus belli for Russia and for Vladimir Putin. I must add, though, that the next day when we had the NATO-Russia Council, which I presided over, Putin made his remark, he's made more frequently afterwards, that Ukraine was not a country but just a territory. And when he said that in that NATO-Russia Council meeting, Merkel immediately took the floor and gave him an answer which left no room for doubt. That was unacceptable, and Ukraine was Ukraine, was a sovereign nation, and what have you. But indeed, the communique finally counted, and that was the text, that was the wording.
Yeah. So if we look back again, right, we can see that the countries that are a part of NATO, there's peace, right? And the countries that are not part of NATO, Russia has intervened, right? So Georgia and Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So looking back, do you think that maybe it would have made more sense to speed up the process of getting these countries into NATO? Because that might have saved them.
No, I don't think so.
No?
It's all speculation, of course. Your question is speculative. My answer is as speculative as the question. I don't think so, because I think when NATO would have speeded up the process, we would have seen the Ukrainian war earlier and a Georgian intervention earlier. Do not forget that this summit was April. In August, he entered Georgia with a huge force, took south Ossetia and Abkhazia, dismembered Georgia, and then went home with his troops. But still, Georgia is dismembered. No. I'm quite sure that had we speeded up that process, we would have seen this horrible war earlier than we're seeing it now.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's very clear. All right, maybe another interesting question is, we know that in the 2000s, it was a different era, right? So there was also a lot of questions regarding NATO as its reason for existing. How was it for you as Secretary General to be Secretary General in a time when a lot of people actually questioned the raison d'être for NATO?
Well, I don't think a lot of people questioned the raison d'être for NATO. But let me briefly come back in answering your question to Russia. When I started my mandate in January 2004, the relationship with Russia was quite good. Was quite constructive. I even had a conversation with Putin, I remember, during which I asked him, could you imagine Russia becoming a NATO member?
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, I must admit, half jokingly, yes, I could, Secretary General, but then à la façon française, which means, as you know, in the political structure, but of course not in the military structure.
Yeah,
France then, as you know, was outside the military structure. No, I do not think too many people questioned NATO's existence. Why was that? That was because immediately after my arrival in Brussels, it became clear that Bush needed very much his eye on the ball in Iraq, and he also had Afghanistan, and that he called on NATO. That's the origin of the whole Afghanistan, the huge NATO operation in Afghanistan. He urged NATO and the NATO allies to take responsibility in Afghanistan, with the US, of course. So NATO was immediately after my arrival in action mode, to use that word, because we had to start in Afghanistan with the so-called provincial reconstruction teams, basically a civilian presence protected by military, which later, of course, as we all know, grew into a huge military operation. But that was the situation in 2004, and NATO's existence was definitely not questioned. NATO was not an alliance in search of a mission. Politically, it was immediate political action was required of me as a Secretary General, and I had, of course, in the beginning as my main responsibility to try to heal the rift, which was in NATO on the basis of Iraq, because many countries had supported, many countries had strongly resisted Bush's invasion into Iraq. So I had to heal the wounds, and healing the wounds with the Americans meant that in the NATO alliance, the general attitude vis-a-vis Afghanistan was relatively positive. More specifically, because in the first instance, as I said, provincial reconstruction teams, PRTs, were civilian exercises, nation-building exercises, yes, indeed, protected by military. But do also not forget that my first trip to Afghanistan was winter 2004, in February, I think, a few weeks after I arrived. I landed in Bagram Airport, or airfield, in Afghanistan, got my first briefing, where the gist of that briefing by Americans was, Secretary General, we don't have a problem, basically, because we have a few Taliban pockets here or there, but that will be over soon. The rest is history. Yeah. It grew into an operation of 100,000 plus military. So that was the start of NATO. And as you know, at the height of the operation, there were 55 NATO members, all NATO members and partners were involved in Afghanistan.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. If we go back to Russia, so you mentioned that Putin half jokingly said that he could see Russia being a part of NATO, but then, right? So what went wrong besides 2008, right? Was it just a personal thing from Putin, or because we all know that NATO is defensive in nature, right? So where did it go wrong, according to you?
Well, it went wrong because Putin got more and more frustrated and showed a lot of rancor as far as NATO enlargement was concerned. In the beginning, I mean, he has documents signed, the Charter of Paris, where he indirectly accepted NATO enlargement. So that's why I said in the beginning it went quite well.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as NATO is concerned, I know fairly exactly the moment that things started to get wrong, because Putin decided to nominate Dmitry Rogozin, mm-hmm, as Russian ambassador to NATO. Now, Dmitry Rogozin is now heading the space program, I think, and making all kinds of threats to NATO nations, was an ambassador with very strong political ambitions in Russia. So he was a typical political appointee. His predecessor was a general of the border guards. Rogozin was very political. Mm-hmm. He came into my office for his first courtesy call with a huge package in his hands. And when I unpacked it, inside was a huge axe, which you could fell trees of a certain, anyway, a huge axe from Siberia with a wooden box. And he said, Secretary General, as you can see, I have come to bury the hatchet. Well, he didn't come to bury the hatchet, because from that moment on, the NATO-Russia Council went into fighting mode.
Yeah.
And so that was a clear signal for me that that Putin was getting serious in resisting NATO enlargement. That proved to be a right analysis, because it went from bad to worse. And when I left in 2009, I thought we were at an all-time low, which was wrong, because now we are at an all-time low with the NATO, which has to go back to forward defense instead of forward presence.
I'm sorry, but there was no space then for diplomacy to say like, hey, we're not going to include these countries in NATO anymore, because a promise still stood, right? That Ukraine and Georgia would become members of NATO, even after the...
Yeah, the promise still stood formally, but everybody knew, as I said a moment ago, that there was never going to be any form of consensus inside NATO that they would become NATO member. And Putin knows this very, very well. I mean, he's no fool. He knows it very, very well that NATO will never... France and Germany, certainly Germany, will never, ever agree in the present European security structure. Of course, that's the caveat. That's the disclaimer. But during this Russia, under this president, there will never be any speak of membership for Ukraine and Georgia. Close relations, yes. Close relations with the European Union, yes, certainly. But not NATO membership. NATO... I come back to Condoleezza Rice. NATO is not going to wage war with Russia, including the risk of a nuclear war over Ukraine. I mean, that will simply not happen. That price is much too high. And that sounds cynical and is a bad message for the Ukrainian people, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, all clear. I think, Peter, you have a question?
Yes, if it is so clear to Russia that to Putin that NATO will never let Ukraine join, then why has it been... such a big thing in the media recently that Russia requires Ukraine to give up its striving for membership, if it knows it will never happen anyway?
Well, because it fits very well into Putin's argument, because Putin will never publicly say that it's never going to happen.
Right.
Putin says it's going to happen. Look at the communique in 2008. I know that it's never going to happen, and Macron knows it, and Scholz knows it. But Putin uses this as a sort of handy argument, as a justification for his unprovoked attack on Ukraine, in combination with their own Nazis and what have you. So, and I say again, that phrase in the communique is a relative phrase, because Putin simply wants his empire back, and communique or no communique, he will simply follow his course.
Right.
And on his menu, as you know, is Moldova as much as Ukraine. Ukraine is the highest price, but Moldova same thing, Georgia same thing, Belarus is already in the pocket because he has saved Lukashenko from being sent out by the streets in Minsk and elsewhere.
Right, so it is used for the public narrative that Putin entertains.
It's of course, and in that public narrative, given the fact that he controls now almost all the media in Russia, he is very successful, of course.
Thank you.
All right, if we then move towards the current conflict in Ukraine, a lot of people are calling for no-fly zones that NATO should instigate, and... I heard a lot of military experts say that that is a very risky undertaking that could lead to nuclear war. So if we can't have a no-fly zone, what is something that NATO could actually do to help Ukraine? Or is it not something that NATO should do, or the EU should rather do? What are your views on this?
Well, my views on this is that NATO as an alliance doesn't send weapons to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. The NATO allies do that, but not NATO as an alliance. There's no NATO weapons policy for Ukraine. But what NATO allies can do, if you ask what NATO can do, I'm very much against a no-fly zone. That is much too risky. And I don't understand why generals like Breedlove and Ben Hodges, four-star U.S. generals,
now
suddenly they have shed their uniform. And now they advocate things they would never have done in uniform. I'm really concerned about that, because a no-fly zone, realize what that means. That means neutralizing air defense, Russian air defense. Russian air defense is located in Ukraine, is located in Kaliningrad, is located in Belarus, is located in Russia proper. What do you do if one of the NATO fighters is shot down out of the air? Are you going to escalate? How are you going to escalate? Are you going to use different kinds of weapons? Are you giving Putin an excuse to cross the threshold to weapons of mass destruction, which he has threatened more than once? So that is the no-fly zone is a foolish idea in my opinion. So what NATO allies can do, and European Union members for that matter, who are not NATO allies, I mean they do exist as well. Take Sweden and Finland as non-NATO allies, not yet anyway, not yet. I should add. They can deliver weapons to Ukraine as much as NATO allies can. It's not the alliance. And if you ask me, so what NATO allies can do, my answer is sending arms into Ukraine, right. where of course the consequence can be that we will see a protracted war with high also civilian casualties, because Russia cannot win and Ukraine cannot lose. That is at the moment a bit the situation in Donbas as well. When the Russians succeed in cutting off a large Ukrainian force, which is in Donbas, they might get the Donbas. But if they don't, it might well be protracted warfare and at the end a frozen conflict. Do not forget that war is already in the Donbas since 2014. For the Donbas, war is nothing new. Putin now wants to have Donbas, wants to annex Donbas. But the jury is still out if he will succeed. I'm not convinced that he will succeed, but he might. And he's now talking about Odessa and Transnistria, which is basically Moldova, of course, part of Moldova. So he might not engage in such an operation now because he doesn't have the forces. But if he can't do it now, he might do it in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years. I mean, that is his ambition, reinstating the empire. And Moldova is as much part of Putin's empire as is Belarus, or as is Georgia, or as is Ukraine, for that matter. But Ukraine is so huge and so big that he doesn't have the forces to have an occupying presence in all over Ukraine.
And then you have the risk that when it turns into, or if it turns into a frozen conflict, then it takes 2 years for him to reorganize, and then he can just launch another attack.
Well,
right?
Why not? If I were Putin, I would certainly check that perspective, and play on the West, which might at a certain stage not be as show the solidarity the West is showing now. I mean, that's all possible. Look at the sanctions and Germany and gas. Yeah. That is already one of the major points of friction and division inside the European Union. Interesting to see if Macron, re-elected, is now going to Scholz and tell Scholz that a gas boycott or a gas embargo is really necessary. My taxation, my analysis is that Germany might in the end not do it. Scholz has internal coalition problems now because the Greens and the Liberals are in favor of going further, but Scholz doesn't want it. So, I mean, Putin might play the card of taking his time and biding his time a bit, à la façon chinoise, I now said, like the Chinese. Yeah. We have the time. We're not in a hurry.
Right.
All right. Makes sense. I think Peter has a question on the future of NATO.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. So some call it a turning point, this war in Ukraine. How do you think this conflict will shape NATO moving forward?
It will reshape Europe. The Europe you and I have known since the end of the Cold War doesn't exist anymore. You'll see a Europe which is divided. You'll see a Europe, and then I come to NATO, where NATO will change from forward presence to forward defense. Forward presence mean deterrence by what's called a tripwire, like we have a very lightish forward presence in the Baltic nations now and in Poland. What we'll see is that NATO will very much strengthen its eastern flank, and with robust military presence, I mean robust, that means thousands of troops with enablers, aircraft being, the air forces being present, a real robust form of deterrence, because deterrence by way of tripwire is of course a different sort of deterrence than when you deter, and when Putin attacks, you have the massive forces in situ in place to immediately react. Now we hope with that forward presence, that tripwire, that we can deter him from doing stupid things. But that's another form of deterrence you will see NATO employing in Europe on its eastern flank from now on. You'll see that from starting at the summit in Madrid in June, where NATO will have to adopt a new strategic concept. Now, everybody thought that would be relatively easy going. We should pay attention to cyber and to space and to China and what have you. And now suddenly, the Cold War is back in the sense that there will be a robust military presence at NATO's eastern border. That's quite new. I mean, imagine my mandate for almost 6 years. It was a very expeditionary NATO. We discussed Afghanistan. NATO was in Kosovo. NATO was even embarking upon a humanitarian operation in Kashmir. NATO was in the Mediterranean. NATO was training the African Union. NATO was in Afghanistan. I mean, NATO was quote-unquote everywhere. And now NATO is again very much focusing, for good reasons and understandable reasons, on its core responsibility, defending the territorial integrity of the NATO area. Political question in the background for me, for NATO, if you ask about the future of NATO, is what consequences the alliance will draw from the fact that in the most recent communique, the summit which was held last year, the communique states, in my own words, that NATO should address the challenges emanating from China. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Does that mean that NATO navies are going to sail the East and South China Seas, that NATO navies will become active in the Indo-Pacific? Or will the Americans say, no, we'll do that with the Australians and others, with the Japanese? NATO, you focus on your own area. I think that is a rather central political point, which I expect to be discussed at the Madrid summit in June.
I think it's interesting that you say you expect Europe to become more divided. I was thinking maybe the opposite happens with Sweden and Finland thinking of joining NATO. Why do you say Europe will be more divided?
No, I'm not speculating on Europe becoming more divided. I linked that to the whole sanctions debate and Germany and gas.
Okay.
No. In NATO, there is still an unprecedented solidarity, as there is in the EU. But the EU is a bit more complicated because the toolbox of the EU is much wider than the toolbox of NATO. No. In NATO, I see solidarity. I see, indeed, as you say, Finland and Sweden on a serious track of joining NATO. Putin will not like this. NATO has 1,300 kilometers of extra border with Russia when Finland joins NATO. But Sweden and Finland, or I should say Finland and Sweden, that's the interesting thing. I always thought that if that moment would come, that Sweden would be in the lead, and now Finland is in the lead, and Sweden is following. We saw the two prime ministers, 2 weeks ago at the press conference. Finland first, and when Finland decides to go in and to apply for membership, I'm pretty sure that Sweden at a certain stage will follow, because they have a bit like Sama at Samitas. We either go in together or we're not going together. But it means strategically for NATO and more particularly for Putin, it means a lot, because it means that the Baltic Sea and the East Sea will become an internal NATO sea. And that is, and think about the map and think about Kaliningrad, that is quite something.
And that's exactly what he doesn't want, right?
Exactly. That is it, basically NATO expansion in a strategically very crucial area. Because defense of the Baltic states, which is always complicated, as you know, because the Baltic states have no strategic depth. So it's very difficult to fight a war in the Baltics, but if you have an unchallenged, which will not be the case, by the way, but an unchallenged naval presence, I mean that makes a big difference. And Putin has to go on appreciating Kaliningrad, because to get into Kaliningrad overland. I mean, he has no free entry to Kaliningrad overland.
Yeah.
That's why the Suwalki Gap is so dangerous there on the Polish-Lithuanian border, because if the Russians or the Belarusians would close that gap, there is no land entry for NATO into the Baltic states. But as you rightly say, Tom, the Finland and Sweden, it's NATO enlargement, NATO expansion. The last thing Vladimir wants.
Right.
I have maybe one last question, if we still have time.
Yes.
You mentioned NATO solidarity that is growing, and I would agree on that now with Biden as president. But what if we have Trump or someone like Trump who becomes president in the United States? Do we still have NATO solidarity that high, or should the Europeans fetch for themselves? Because then we're in real trouble, right?
Yes, I think when you mention NATO and you mention Trump or a Trump clone in the White House after 2024, it is Houston we have a problem.
Yeah,
definitely, because I have read Peril, the Woodward book on Trump, and Trump. I'm not saying he was on the brink of changing the position, his position vis-a-vis NATO, but he was close. I think at the end of the day, if that scenario would happen, that Congress would refuse any president to leave NATO, but we have big trouble in NATO, and that has consequences for Europe as well. And that is why, although I have been a staunch Atlanticist all my life, in this regard, the bell for Europe rings very loudly, and Europe should definitely organize its own defenses, not for Article 5 NATO scenarios. You'll have the Americans, certainly under Biden, fulfilling their obligation. I'm not advocating, by the way, a European nuclear weapon, because the ultimate guarantee, of course, is the US, and Europe developing a nuclear weapon is not something I would advocate. Neither would the French or the British. Again, what is the European Union without the Brits in defense terminology? Not much, only France.
Yeah.
Because Germany, like the Netherlands, the Bundeswehr needs 15 years to make up for decades of cuts. The Bundeswehr is in a disastrous position and condition. So are the Dutch armed forces, by the way. Also takes 10 to 15 years. So a Trump in the White House in 2024 is the worst of all scenarios I can imagine.
Brussels, we have a problem.
Brussels, we have a problem, indeed.
Yeah, well, a call to action. I think that's a troubling but also necessary way to end this episode. So, thank you very much for being here. It was very nice to have an inside view as well.
Thank you so much. Have a nice evening and bye for the moment, right?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, bye now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.